What I'm going to do is just talk very briefly. In some ways, the others have covered what I wanted to, because I think one of the most significant things about the whole process has been the reports. I mean, that's what you really see when you're out in the field. And I just want to bring out a couple of things, some of these related to the reports, some of them otherwise. One of the interesting things, the Pew Global Attitude Survey, which is a very credible organization, they've done an international survey. And one of the questions was, living in a country where I can freely practice my religion is important. Not surprisingly, everyone said yes. So, but it's quite interesting. A little lower in Eastern Europe, I guess, part because it has not been such a critical part of things. But it's interesting to see those numbers now. I wish I could. Let's see if I can move. This is not a good setup. I'm sorry. I think there are a number of negative perceptions of IRFA from the beginning. Conservative Christian origins, United States unilateralism, worries about neo-imperialism, foreign policy biases, worries about inaccurate data. And then also something that always irritates people, there's a report for all the countries except the United States. Now, I want to suggest that a number of these things really are misleading criticisms. I think one can be candid, as our speakers have been, about problems. But the reality is, while things started out as a kind of conservative Christian issue, by the time it went through, it had really been broadened out to take into account the full spectrum of religious activities. U.S. unilateralism can be a problem, but I think the neo-imperialism thing, I think the people I've worked with, the real concern is international standards. People understand that different countries have different histories, different traditions on these issues, but there are common levels, minimum bases that really ought to be respected. Foreign policy bias, I mean, it's well known with the human rights reports that are in a way similar, that they sometimes get held hostage by who the country's friends are and who they're not. This is somewhat inevitable given that you're dealing with a big bureaucracy, but basically the religion reports have been quite reliable. And the hypocrisy, the reason the U.S. doesn't do a report on itself is that the U.S. doesn't have a foreign policy with itself. That's domestic policy. The International Religious Freedom Act it's not trying to tell other countries what they should do. It's trying to tell the U.S. government how they should conduct their foreign policy in ways that might more effectively motivate people to keep the commitments that they have independently made. Positive impacts. I think the point that President Young pointed out, the sympathetic listeners, that there's someone there in a lot of countries to whom a group having problems can go and not only have a sympathetic listener, but a listener that may actually be able to do something, not always, but sometimes, that's very significant. I think there is a factor that sometimes there's a leverage factor that's very important. I will always remember once being in Romania and having someone from the president's administration come to me and say, we're under tremendous pressure in our country to do some things that we know would violate international standards. Is there some way from the outside that you can give us some leverage so that we can counterbalance some of these internal domestic pressures? I think that can sometimes be important, and I think many of you are sometimes in positions where that might be helpful. I think it also creates added sensitivity to some of the problems that are going on. Now, what I want to stress is, on the one hand, these reports at one level are not the most... I can imagine more elaborate social science studies and so forth. But I have to tell you, before these came out, there was relatively little information. And one of the things that's been valuable is that the reports do give us coverage for a lot of countries in the world. And while it's true that typically the people in the embassies are sort of some of the lower level people in the embassies, they get very good guidance, and there's been a lot of experience from Washington in how to structure these, what kinds of issues to look for. And so over time, I think these have become quite effective. Now, one of the things that's been done is some social scientists have studied them. This is the Association of Religion Data Files. I'm giving you the website if you want to look at this. But they've gone through and coded, it was the 2003 reports, so they have very detailed analysis of the reports. And those are now being used for different kinds of studies. They broke down something like 243 factors that they looked at and sorted out in ways that look basically at government regulation, government favoritism, social regulation. Before we had these, there were just a lot of problems. There was impressionistic data. There was some information, but it was not collected in a very effective way. I'm sure this can still be improved, but it's one of the other problems. No one has the wherewithal to do multiple country studies. There are some other countries. I take it the EU could do this. They've got embassies in countries all over the world, but just the cost of having people on the ground in different countries is hard to replicate. There's a religion-specific kind of focus. One of the other problems is a lot of the other studies would look at very subjective factors that would make it hard to know, hard to deal with the information. Now, one of the things that's come out of the information is, what this graphic is designed to show is that there is a very high correlation between religious freedom in countries and the other things that are circled here. Some of these are obvious. I mean, if you have a high degree of religious freedom, you have civil liberty, political liberty, and so forth. That's not a surprise. Those tend to go together in regimes. But there are also significant correlations with higher gross domestic product, better incomes for both women and men, a consolidation of democracy, that is, there's a much higher survival rate of democracy in countries that have religious liberty, better health and education. I mean, it's quite interesting that there are these very strong correlations. There are some additional things. I've mentioned these. Where religious freedom is high, there are fewer incidents of armed conflict, there are better health outcomes, higher levels of earned income, better educational opportunities for women, higher overall human development as measured by UN Human Development indexes. Now, of course, you can have correlation. Correlation doesn't automatically mean causation. I mean, it could be that the other things are causing the religious freedom and not vice versa. But there are some indications with this data that there really is causation. Number one, religious competition, which is implied by religious freedom, results in increased religious participation in society. Religious participation leads to a variety of positive outcomes. And this is just a little chart. You get broader participation. That unleashes various kinds of positive contributions. I'll give some examples like volunteerism and so forth. And you get a kind of positive cycle. A lot of these things come from work on this basic data that's been done by Brian Grimm. So here's some examples of the cycle. Research in 143 countries shows that religious violence is lower if there are no barriers to competition. Sometimes countries think that if they sort of reduce the number of countries, different competitors, as you will, in the religious market, that it will make things more peaceful. But the evidence seems to go the other way. Countries without restrictions on conversions have higher levels of fundamental freedoms. Religious social capital. Members of religious congregations give larger amounts to charities than people who are not involved. And this is true both for secular and non-secular, religious and secular charities. Regular attendees at religious worship services give larger amounts to charities, again, religious or secular. Members of religious congregations volunteer and volunteer more hours to charitable organizations than others. Regular attendees at worship services volunteer more hours to charitable organizations. So these are just some of the ways that religious liberty, by opening up and encouraging participation and unleashing the kind of altruism that's associated with religion, how it works. I think I'll skip this. There's also, on the other side, a kind of problem going the other direction. Often social factors will cause restrictions. Those will reinforce, that can lead to various kinds of violence, various kinds of problems, and you can get a negative cycle. The point of these charts is that the correlations between religious liberty and the other things are quite clear, but these start suggesting mechanisms why greater religious liberty may actually be a causal factor in explaining those correlations and not just a result. So it's a limited tool. Its effectiveness has gone down as U.S. Influence and credibility has been eroded. It provides some significant leverage that can be used. And it's a reminder of the need in an increasingly pluralistic world to facilitate positive religious freedom cycles and diffuse the negative ones. Okay, let's